Whoops. Okay, so let's go ahead and get started. So first, we have one announcement about the assignment, and that is, so the assignment will be posted on the website and to the course mailing list. It should be either this afternoon, probably this afternoon, but no later than tomorrow. And you'll have 3 weeks to work on the assignment. So it will be due, it should be the last Thursday, right? So 25th. So it'd be the last Thursday. This will all be on the assignment sheet. But it'll be due the last Thursday of the semester, so Thursday of week 10. I think that's the 25th, but I don't know for sure without looking at a calendar. So you'll have 3 weeks to do that. So that will come out very soon. Hopefully it'll be substantially the same. It'll be of a similar style to the labs. So hopefully okay, so today I want to talk about neural networks and using neural networks as a classifier. So basically, neural networks. So up until now, we've been talking about mostly linear classifiers for which the decision boundary is a hyperplane in the space of features. And we've said, well, if I want a more complex decision boundary than a hyperplane, then what you should do is you should make up new features, like, for example, powers like polynomials based on the original features, and that'll give you a nonlinear decision boundary. And that can be very effective in practice, but sometimes I'd like to be able to learn these nonlinear basis functions for the classifier. And so artificial neural networks basically give you a way to do that. And that's what we're going to talk about today, and then the readings are on the bottom here. So in order to build up networks of neurons, let's talk about what a single neuron does. So basically, the idea. So neural networks, in some sense, have this unfortunate oversold name, right? That people were really excited about the analogy to what neurons did, and they tried to say, well, how can we take this at the time, very simplified understanding of what neurons did, and try to use that to make a mathematical machine that did learning. So their idea about what a neuron did is this is going to be a little bit embarrassing if I try to say something about neurons. Stop. Okay, so their simplified idea was that a neuron looks something like this. So this is a cell. So this was some kind of nucleus, although we don't actually care about the nucleus. So their idea was, well, you've got these are dendrites. So there are other neurons that are connecting through to these dendrites. And then if this gets enough, so it's receiving information from some other neurons in the brain here. And the idea is, well, what this guy's going to do is he's going to add them all up. And if he gets excited enough by the neurons that are coming in, then he's going to send an electrical pulse down his output, which is called an axon. And that was basically their model of how a neuron worked. And my understanding is that's very oversimplified. But I don't know enough about neurons to tell you what's oversimplified about it. But this was, at least by analogy, this is what they were thinking of as an individual unit in an artificial neural network. So, here is the maths for what a single artificial neuron looks like. So the idea is that you have some features X, like before, and each individual neuron is going to have a set of weights W. And you just take a linear function and to order to see what's the activation of that neuron. So how much energy is it getting from its other neurons as input? And so you just take that linear function there of x transpose w. And that gives you this real number a, which is the activation for that neuron. And then what you do is as a function of the activation of the neuron, you decide whether it's going to fire or not. So the output Y represents whether the neuron is going to fire. So if you have, if you want to think of the neuron as being, so for example, you might have a neuron whose output is 0 or or 0 or 1, minus 1 or 1, those are very common. So then you need some kind of activation function, which looks like some kind of squashing function, that says on the basis of the activation, what is the neuron, how's the neuron going to fire? So there are different kinds of examples of activation functions you could have here. So for example, if you had a continuous neurons, you could use the sigmoid function that we've seen before to convert this real number a from minus infinity to infinity to something that's between 0 and 1. Another kind of squashing function you can use is this tan h, which is the hyperbolic tangent. So that just gives you another squashing function that maps, you think of it as something that maps real numbers to the space minus 1 to 1. So it's in some ways similar to the sigmoid, and then in some ways it's different. Another kind of thing is you might not have any activation function at all. You might say you just want the activation of the unit to be linear, and that'll be useful, and maybe that'll be useful somewhere else in the network. You know, or you might want the output of the neuron to be exactly 1 or minus 1. And then if you do that, you could just set a threshold and say if A is big enough, or if A is greater than 0, then I'll map it to 1 and minus 1 otherwise. And so that's basically the idea of what a single neuron does. And so this should be very familiar to you, right? Because if I just have a single neuron, then and I do say I do a sigmoid activation function, or even a hyperbolic tangent activation function, then what I'm doing is just a linear classifier, right? For the sigmoid unit, one neuron is just logistic regression. Or if I had a linear threshold, then I could do linear regression with a single neuron. So that's not necessarily so interesting. It seems like we've just taken stuff we knew about before and kind of done some new salesmanship branding on it. But we can combine these to do something more interesting. So before I talk about that, I'll go through a little bit of a history. Especially starting in the 40s and 50s, people were really excited about the single neuron model. You could train a single, if you used the step function as your activation function, then you got this kind of classic classifier, which was called a perceptron. And people had a training rule for this, I won't go through it, but it was similar, but not exactly the same, has stochastic gradient descent. And then, throughout history, looking at these simple rules, what can this simple perceptron learn, and what can it not represent? And so that's kind of was the basis for the things that we've seen, earlier about the linear separability of data sets, that people eventually figured out that, a single perceptron can't represent, because it's a linear classifier, it can't represent a distinction that's not linearly separable. So it's kind of interesting. So a lot of these ideas we've seen before actually came out of this interest in neural networks. Okay, so as we've seen, so we could say, suppose I want to represent some kind of more flexible decision boundary that's not linearly separable. So what can I do? You could say, by analogy to the brain, maybe I can connect these neurons to each other. So I'll connect these simple units in such a way that the input to one unit farther down the line is just the output of some earlier unit, and then the input to the first level of units is going to be my actual features. That's an interesting idea. That's the basic idea behind neural networks. But obviously you can't just use linear network. You can't just use linear units when you do this. Because if I compose two linear functions, then I still get a linear function. So you might say I need some non-linearity in the network. So that's what makes it interesting to say, suppose I'll take a non-linear neuron. So I'll take something that has, say, a sigmoid or a hyperbolic tangent squashing function. Then what happens if I connect them together? So I'll take one layer of individual units, each of which are doing this very simple squashed linear function, and then I connect them to another layer, that actually significantly expands the set of decision boundaries that I can represent. And then if I try to train this whole the weights of this entire network based on data, then the way you can think about it is the first layer learns nonlinear features adaptively from data. So let's take a look at this more specifically. The one thing that's kind of a little bit funny to point out is that it turns out these things actually never were. I mean, the name is kind of a little bit sad because these things never were very good models of neurons. But it turns out they can actually be reasonably good classifiers if you get them to work. So they're kind of interesting to look at. They're kind of less interesting to look at maybe if you're interested in neuroscience, but they're reasonably interesting to look at if you're interested in classification. Okay, so here's what one of these things would look like. So here, so we have this, we call it input layer, which is just a feature vector in the same way that we've seen throughout the course. So you can think of each one of these squares represents one component in the vector x. And so what I've done is, so we're going to arrange this neural network in a series of layers. Each one of these circles represents a neuron, and each neuron is going to do the same kind of linear plus activation function that we talked about on the first slide. So what's going to happen is so let's just take the first hidden layer. Suppose I've told you each neuron is going to have a set of weights. So let's start and say, suppose I've told you the weights for the entire network. Each weight vector is going to have the same cardinality as the number. I'll have one weight for each input. So these things in the first layer will have one weight for each feature, just like the linear classifiers that we've seen so far. So if I take I take this neuron on the left, he's going to have his own set of weights. He's going to take the dot product of his weights to these input vectors, and then he's going to put it through this squashing function, and that will I do have this thing. He's going to put it through his squashing function, and then he's going to send that thing as this input to the neuron on the next layer. And this guy here is also going to have his weights. He's going to have a different set of weights. And so he's going to get a different function of these inputs that he now sends both to this neuron and to this neuron here. So that's what all three of these guys in the hidden layer do, hidden layer one do. Now you can have more than one hidden layer, right? Once I've kind of defined this recursive rule, I could in principle do any kind of topology I want, as long as there aren't any cycles. So for example, I could have a network with two hidden layers. It's like on this slide. And what these guys will do is they'll just look at the inputs that they got from these guys, and do the same kind of linear classification thing as if these guys were the inputs. So these guys won't know what the original inputs of the problem are. They'll just know what these kind of processed versions of the inputs are. So then they'll do the same thing of take a linear function and then do the squashing and then send this to these guys on the output. And then finally, these guys here do the same kind of linear squashing thing, and then they give me the final output. So for example, if I were doing a classification problem, I would just put one node in the output layer. And that could be, if it was a binary class label, then I have one node in the output layer, and that would give me a 0 or 1 through the squashing function, and I'd be done. Whereas it might be the case I might want to represent multiple outputs, so if I were doing, say we're doing a 10-class classification problem rather than a binary one, then I could just have 10 binary units, and then each of them says 0, 1 about whether they think that's a class level. There are lots of different representations that you could use. But this is the basic diagram about how a neural network works. So this is called I think I'll introduce this in the next slide, but I'll just write it up now. I'll say it now. This is called a feed-forward neural network because I've arranged the neurons in layers such that they only look at the guys on the last layer. There's no reason that you'd have to, and this is a fully connected network, in the sense that each of these guys looks at all of the activations of all of the neurons in the previous layer in order to decide what his activation is going to be. Now, you could relax both of those assumptions, right? You could let these neurons in the hidden layer too. You could let them get to see the input layer. You could just add extra arcs here and just add more weights, and now they get to see both the input layer and this kind of non-linearly processed version of the inputs from the hidden layer. That's perfectly fine. Another thing that's interesting to do is you might not want this to be fully connected. If there's a large number of neurons on each layer, you might not want to learn the large number of weights that you would need in order for this neuron to depend on all of these neurons here. So you could just have sparse connections between the layers, and that's also a kind of reasonable, interesting thing to do. Okay, so this is basically just for your reference later on what I've just said. So you can view each layer as being kind of a nonlinear function of the input. And so you're actually going to learn this nonlinear function from data. If you decide to use a logistic squashing function, then this is called a multi-layer perceptron. And that's what we're going to focus on in today. So the if you wanted to do, you could use neural networks for both classification and regression. So that would be, we talked in the first slide about how you could just have a linear output function and not do this nonlinear squashing. So if you wanted to use a neural network for a regression task, what you could do is you could have nonlinear, you don't want to have linear transfer functions everywhere. So this thing G, the squashing function, is also called a transfer function. You don't want to do that everywhere, because then you'd just be doing linear regression. But if in the hidden layers, you have nonlinear functions, and then at the final layer, you have the transfer function being linear, then the total result of the network will be that if I look at the output node, then I'll get a real number, and I can use that for regression. Or then if you wanted to do classification, then you could just use the logistic function for classification like we talked about before. Okay, so that's how once I've given you a neural network, how you use it to do classification or regression. So before we talk about how you would learn the weights of an artificial neural network, let's talk a little bit more about the representation power that you get. So it turns out that unlike a single neuron, so unlike a perceptron, which we've seen has kind of very limited representational capability. I don't need a very deep neural network in order to get a very flexible representation ability. So, I mean, basically the result is that neural networks are universal approximators in the sense that once I add one hidden layer, so if I have an input layer, a hidden layer, and then an output layer, that neuron can represent pretty much any function that I'm interested in. So, for example, so in the case of Boolean functions, so by Boolean functions, I mean ones where the components in the input layer are all 0, 1, and the output that I want is 0, 1. So then it's actually not that difficult to see that I could represent any Boolean function that I want by a network with a single hidden layer. Because you can make the hidden layer very, very large. Right, so if I took some Boolean function and then I could write that as a logical formula, and then I could just use one neuron for each component in the formula. So if I'm allowed an extremely large number of hidden units, I could represent any Boolean function that I want. And it turns out that the same thing, something similar, is true for continuous functions. So in particular, if I have any continuous function can be approximated to arbitrary accuracy if I have a network with two hidden layers, and you can think of that intuitively. You can think of like different neurons in the network. You can think of different neurons in the network want to approximate different regions of different parts of the function. So by having a very large number of hidden units, you can specialize different hidden units to different areas in the continuous function, and get a universal approximator that way. So it turns out if I'm allowed to use, the nice thing is that, well, I know in some sense I'm not giving. If I were allowed to use an arbitrarily large neural network, I wouldn't be giving anything up in terms of representational power, like I am in a linear model. So that's something that's very nice. Here's kind of a visual example of the kind of flexibility that you get. So this is from a nice textbook by David Mackay, and what this is you take a two-layer feed-forward network. Like one that I showed in the previous slide, and it's two input units and one continuous. I think this is a continuous output unit. So this would be like I'm doing a regression task on a bivariate regression task, right? So we want to get some idea of what kinds of functions are natural in some sense for a neural network to represent. You know, what kinds of things if I didn't have any data at all. What are functions that a neural network likes to represent, right? It should like to represent things that are smooth, right? Because I'm always taking kind of these linear functions and then doing the smooth squashing. But you know, what kinds of things do I get? So the way that Mackay got at this was really very interesting. What he said is, I'm going to take each unit of the network, And I'm going to issue it into the network, has its own set of weights. I'm just going to sample those weights randomly and see what kinds of functions that I get. So he took something which had a very large number of hidden units, each of these two layers, and then each of the weights, he chose them randomly from a Gaussian distribution, and they kind of looked at the functions that you get. And one example of them is this function here. So you get this thing that you can see you have, you can definitely this fairly flexible function. You can get some kind of trends over time, but you get this you know, kind of very large number of smooth bumps. And this is kind of typical of a function that you could, although you can represent a lot of flexible representational power, it's kind of interesting to see, you know, what are typical functions that I get from randomly chosen weights. So here's an example of something similar, but for a classification task rather than a regression task. So what this is from a neural network that's trying to predict vowels given speech. And so the class labels are words that are basically the same word except for the vowel in the middle. And I see that it looks like you might be able to read them from here. These are kind of phonetic representations of, like, so different class labels would be like head versus hood would be two different classes. And I'm trying to do essentially automatic speech recognition using this kind of neural network. So these are two different features that were processed from the acoustic data. And this is kind of a representation of what the decision boundaries are of these 10 classes with the data. So each of those lines is kind of the boundary that the network has on these 10 classes. And so you see you can get quite arbitrary shapes on this kind of thing because of these nonlinear functions that you get in the hidden layer. These nonlinear transformations that you define in the hidden layer in the hidden layers of the neural network. Okay, so those are all the things that are good about neural networks, but it's important not to take these advantages too seriously. And there are two kind of caveats here. The first one, actually probably more than two. We'll see how many I've actually written out. Okay, so one is that just because I could represent a function by a neural network with two layers and a million hidden units on each layer, that doesn't mean that I could represent it based on a compact network. Right? So if I require, you know, exponentially many hidden units or millions or billions of hidden units in order to represent some function accurately, then maybe that's not so useful because that would have so many, that'd be computationally expensive to train, and I would have so many parameters that I'd need a lot of data in order to train that model. So that's one reason that these results about representational power need to be taken with a little bit of a grain of salt. And that's also a reason why you might say, well, given these results about the representational power of neural networks, why would I ever have a network with more than two hidden units? If I can represent any more than two hidden layers, right? If I can represent any function at all with two hidden layers, then, you know, why do I need more? And well, one answer is that maybe by using more hidden layers, I might use fewer units in total. So that's one caveat about these results. Another kind of caveat is just because I can represent a function doesn't mean that I can learn it, right? So I haven't talked. So I'm going to talk about learning in a few minutes. But, you know, still, I mean, we've seen for it, you know, just because I still have to search for the weights, even if I can represent some function that separates my training data well, I still have to find the set of weights that does that. And finding that in neural networks, it's going to turn out, is actually a fairly computationally intensive problem. And then the final thing is, even if I could find a very good, even if I have a neural network structure that's very good for my particular problem, and even if I have a really good training procedure, such that, you know, if I give it the right data, it's going to go straight to that weight vector, it doesn't say anything about how much data I need before I can actually, before I get enough information about what the real weight vector is. So if I have a neural network with a large number of parameters, or any kind of model with a large number of parameters, I expect to need more training data in order to find a good set of parameters. So these representation results don't tell me anything about how much training data I need in practice, especially compared to other learning methods, about how to actually learn a good function. And in fact, based on what we've said before about overfitting, you might very well think that this kind of these representation power results might be a double-edged sword. Right? If I have a network structure that's very, very flexible, then I'm not placing any bias about the sets of decision boundaries that I can represent. I'm not placing very much bias on the sets of decision boundaries that I want to represent. So I might be afraid of being in some situation like this high-dimensional polynomial regression that we saw earlier in the course, where if I have an extremely large number of parameters, then I can just fit the training data exactly and then do wild things outside of the training data. This is a nice thing to know, but it's not necessarily as large of an advantage as you might think. Okay, so now that I've talked about how neural networks, you know, represent a decision problem, let me talk a little bit more about how they're trained. So we're going to do the same thing that we've seen from linear regression, logistic regression, and SVMs, which is we're going to cast the learning problem as an optimization problem. So we're going to take we're going to have an error function that says, well, given the output of the neural network, I'm going to go and try to fit them to the. I'm going to talk about supervised training of neural networks. So given the output of f of x of the neural network, I'm going to say, does that agree to the actual target for some input in my training data? So I want to create a loss function, and depending on whether I'm doing classification or regression, that'll change what the loss function is. So if I'm doing regression, then squared error is a very natural loss function, just like we've seen for linear regression. And so if you take on the second line, the only difference between between the squared error loss for a neural network and a squared error loss for linear regression is that I'm computing the model in a different way. So this thing f of xi is going to be different, but otherwise this is the same loss function that we use for linear regression. Whereas if I'm doing classification, then it's reasonable to say, well, I'll put a sigmoid output on the last a sigmoid transfer function on the output nodes, and that'll give me this f of xi, which is now a number between 0 and 1, and then I can use the same loss function that I used for linear regression that says, well, if the class label in the data is 1, then I want log f of xi to be very big, whereas if this thing is 0, then I want 1 minus f of then I want f of xi to be close to 0. So these are both, and so you can actually think of these, so we talked before about maximum likelihood training, and you can actually think of these as the log likelihood of the data under some probability model. So it's not, I mean, neural networks, so we've talked about, if you're taking PMR, then you've seen lots of, which, I mean, a lot of you aren't, but some of you aren't, then you've seen lots of different methods for graphical models. And you can actually, I won't go into detail about this, but you can actually think of neural networks in some sense as some kind of graphical model. You can think of them as defining a likelihood in the sense that, you know, if I imagine it, if I imagine a Gaussian, in the same way as in linear regression, if I imagine a Gaussian distribution, if say I'm doing regression using a neural network, then if I imagine a Gaussian distribution over the one node in the output, then I can kind of view this as being a log likelihood coming from that Gaussian distribution in the same way as we did for linear regression. So the nice thing, you can use the same general framework for optimization that we've done in the other learning methods that we've seen so far. But there's an important difference between neural networks and all of the other methods that we've seen so far, and that is technically in the case of neural networks, neither of these loss functions are any longer convex. So what that means is that the optimization function over the optimization problem over W, there's no longer one unique optimum. There are lots of bumps and lots of local minima. So what that means, there are lots of weight vectors where locally it looks like I fit the weight locally, the gradient of these losses with respect to this weight vector is going to be zero. So it looks like if I just look in the intermediate neighborhood, I can't see any other weight vector that does better on the training data than the one that I'm at. But if I went really far away from where I'm at, then there might be some much better training, the much better weight vectors. So some much better global optimum than the local optimum. And you can actually kind of see that from this picture here, right? It makes sense that if you look at these, so that thing on the slide was f of xi, right? It's for a given xi. What that graph is of f of xi. So if f of xi is this complex multimodal function, and then I take some kind of simple error function of it here, I can't expect this e to somehow be magically a nice unimodal function just because I squared this nasty multimodal function. And that's basically what you see in general, is that if this f of xi is nice and convex, then the error function tends to be. Whereas this, if this f of xi, for any kind of learning method, is kind of a multimodal complex kind of thing, then this thing, then the likelihood, or the error function, tends also to be multimodal and very complex. And you know, a very simple way to see why the error function doesn't have a unique optimum is just to think about neural networks with one hidden layer. Right? What I could do is if I take a neural network with one hidden layer and I permute all of the neurons on the hidden layer. So by this I mean I just pick two neurons and swap their weight vectors. And then swap the input weights and then swap their input weight vectors. And then for everybody that talks to them, swap the weights at the next level. Then obviously you're going to get the same answer at the end, even though it's a different weight vector. So just by that observation, you can see that I have exponentially many. Given any weight vector w, there are exponentially many other different weight vectors that have exactly the same likelihood. And it turns out that's not the only kind of multimodality that that neural networks have, but that's one of them. Okay, so now what kind of training method are we going to use? So well, now that we have a loss function, we can optimize it in any way that we want based on any of the optimization methods that we talked about earlier. One optimization method that's kind of both useful and historically important is called backpropagation. And the idea behind you can explain backpropagation in two ways. So one way you could say is it's a way for neurons at the highest level to say, so if my output neuron sees that it has a very high error, so if I'm not classifying the training data well, what do you want to happen during learning? Well, what you want is for the output neuron to look at all the other neurons that are talking to it, says, well, which neurons are influencing me the most on this input, and let me propagate that error back to those neurons. Now, I'll give each of them a share of my error and tell them to fix themselves, you know, based on that error signal. So that's kind of a way of decomposing this network-based problem. I'm only getting one error for each training instance. I'm getting one error signal for the entire network. And somehow I want to convert that into an error signal for every single unit. So the idea of backpropagation is a way to do that. Now, so from that, it sounds like, well, backpropagation might be this crazy complex procedure. But it's not. It's really just gradient descent. So everything I said, which is a fancy intuition behind, well, take the gradient. So it turns out that if you take the gradient with respect to the parameters, so if you take the gradient of this thing E with respect to the parameters, and then you use the chain rule, it's actually very easy to compute the derivatives of the derivatives of the weights for every node in the network has a function of the input. And if you actually look at the gradients that you get, then it has that you can come up with this interpretation of that the error for that the error for each unit is a function of the errors of the units that are upstream in the network. And so what you do is, so the way that you compute this is first you compute the error for the output node, and then you work backwards using the chain rule to compute the errors for every node for the upstream nodes in the network. And then once you have the gradient, then you can use any optimization method you want. So you could use any of the optimization methods that we talked about earlier. You could do batch optimization using these kind of fancy first order methods or fancy second order methods. You could use Newton's method if you had a small number of parameters. Historically, the most common method is online gradient descent. So I'll talk about, and I think I have that on the next slide. But before I get to that, just like with any of the other likelihood methods that we've talked about, you can use a regularization. So you can say, well, I want to kind of, and that's often a very good thing to do. So you can add another term to the likelihood, which is just the norm of the weight vector squared, and then say, well, I want to find a weight vector that doesn't just have low error, but also has the weights as small as possible. And that's a good thing to do to control overfitting. Okay, so I've talked about this, I've had this slide before. I just want to bring this up again in the context of neural networks, because typically typically online training methods are very common in neural networks. So if you think about, I just want to explain again what an online training method is. If you look at any of the error functions on the previous slide, the error function itself
was the sum over all training instances of the error function on that instance. Right, so that's true. If you look at four squared error or for the log loss, it always had this summation form. And that came from thinking of the training instances as being IID, if you wanted to think about it statistically. So that means if you take the gradient, then you still get an additive form. So if I take the gradient of the error with respect to the parameters, then I'll get just the sum over all training instances of the gradient of the error of that instance with respect to the parameters. So typically, if you kind of naively used the gradient descent rule, the first gradient descent rule that I talked about in the optimization lecture, then that would be a batch method. So in order to take one, if I took steps with respect to the gradient E of delta E delta theta, then what that would mean is I'd have to look through every single training instance in order to compute that error. And that's a reasonable thing to do. But you might think, well, if the training data tend to be redundant, so if they tend to contain a lot of the same information, then maybe I shouldn't have to fully scan every training instance in order to get the best set of parameters. And so that's this idea behind online learning, which is also called stochastic gradient descent. So what that says is, let me just take one training instance. So I'll say pick some training instance I. So maybe I'll go through them in some order, or maybe I'll pick them randomly. And then once I've picked a training instance, I'll compute the gradient of EI on that training instance, and just that training instance. And then I'll take just one gradient. I'll take a small gradient step with that instance. And so that can be that's something that can be that's a very powerful method, especially in modern data sets. If I'm getting streaming data, if I have kind of financial data or web data or something like that, where I'm constantly getting training instances, if I'm getting like say 10 training instances a second or something like that, and I need to constantly adapt my classifier, then online methods are very interesting. And so they've received a lot more attention recently in the research community for that reason. Now, the disadvantage of online learning is that it's quite a bit harder to tune. And the reason for that is that it becomes even more important to choose the step size parameter for gradient descent in a nice way. And the reason for that is you wouldn't want to try to exactly minimize EI with respect to theta, because that would be stupid. Well, what that means is each of these EIs has a different, each of these EIs has a set of local optima, right? And then when I sum them together into the big objective function, I get some kind of different combined set of local optima. So if I went too far to maximizing each of the individual EIs, then I just kind of bounce around. You know, I'd find a local optimum for one training instance, and then once I got another one, I'd find some completely different local optimum for the other training instance. So I'd never converge to a single right answer if I had too large of a learning rate. But then if I had too small of a learning rate, then I won't step anywhere, because I'll just be making tiny, tiny steps. So it can be very important to tune the step size in a stochastic gradient descent. And then it also can be, you can even tune the order of presentation. So usually presenting the instances randomly can be better than presenting them in a fixed order in online gradient descent. So what that means, training these things can really be a black art. There are people who are very, very good at getting stochastic gradient descent to work for neural networks, and I've never had the patience to do that. But the caveat is, you really need to know what you're doing. So here are some other issues that you can that are important with backpropagation. So another issue that we have now that we've never had before is this idea of local optima, right? So just because backpropagation looks like it converges to something, that doesn't mean I found a good solution, right? I could have just converged to a very bad local minimum of the error. So typically what people do is they do random restarts. So because there are multiple local minima, if I start from a different place, I'm going to end up in a different place, right? Because I might have started in some place that's closer to some different point of the objective function. So what you do is you train multiple nets randomly from different starting places, and then choose the one that has the best error, or you could choose them to vote in some way. And that's one thing. Another related issue is that when you have methods that are that have local minima, then initialization becomes much more important. So a nice thing about SVMs or logistic regression is that because they're based on convex optimization problems, they only have one minimum. So it doesn't matter where I start the optimization problem, what my initial weight vector is for when I start computing the gradients, wherever I start, I'll go downhill and end up in the same place. If I have multiple local minima, that's no longer the case. And it can become very important where you initialize the weights. So, I mean, there are examples of models in the research literature where people spend a lot of time thinking about a very, very clever initialization of the weights for a neural network. And then based on that initialization, they try it, and they actually get significantly better classification performance at the end. So it's completely a black art. A common strategy, if you don't know anything better, is to initialize the weights to be randomly in near zero. And that usually tends to be better than initializing them exactly at zero. So those are kind of some practical issues in training neural networks using backpropagation. So a summary for everything so far for how to train neural networks is that just to kind of review each unit in the network, each neuron has its own weight vector, its own bias, and we're going to train them all at the same time. And then you can use any, now that once we've cast it as an optimization problem, you can use any optimization method you want. Gradient descent is simple and commonly used, but it turns out it can be slow. It is not unusual on a large-scale data set for a neural network to require, a day or two to train. These things can be very, very complex. If you have a small enough problem where you can use a second order method, that can also be a good thing to do as well. So the other thing that I want to just to summarize, there are a lot of black art. Neural networks can be a very effective classifier. And then you can see in a lot of problems that they have that they're competitive to other classification methods like SVMs. But actually applying them can be a bit of a pain, not only because you have to go through all of the issues and how to train them and deal with local minima, but also you have to figure out what the structure of the network is, right? Because every different, how many hidden layers do you want to use? How many units do you want to have at each hidden layer? How do you want to connect the neurons from one layer to the next? What kinds of transfer functions do you want to use? It can be there's not really a lot of guidance on how to pick those, except to try different ones and see how they do in some validation set. So it can be there's a lot of little knobs that you have which can help you get better performance, but then you also have to spend a lot of time figuring out how to set them. Okay, so you can fit this. So I just have this kind of slide that we've seen before about kind of separating the model structure from the task and the score function, the optimization procedure. And so we've seen that if you pick the model structure for neural networks, you still have a lot of freedom in terms of what task, whether a classification or regression task, and whether you want to, even if you say, I want to use the log likelihood as a score function, you have a lot of choices in what, different error functions tend to correspond to different likelihoods. So you still have some choice about whether to use, say, a quadratic score function versus a logistic score function. And then you can use any numerical optimization you want as a search method for optimization. Okay, so basically the so we I wanted to talk a little bit about the so we've had this concept before of the inductive bias of classifiers. So for example, linear classifiers had a very strong inductive bias because they would only consider linear decision boundaries of the input. For neural networks, it's very, very hard to classify what the inductive bias is. Certainly, choosing a particular network structure restricts the possible set of weights that you can represent. Restricts your weight space, and has some restriction on the set of functions that you can represent. But these things are so large and complicated that it's hard to know. If I have some neural network with 2 layers and 10 units, well, what is the family of functions it can represent? In general, it's hard to characterize that. So basically, one thing about neural networks that we can say intuitively is, at least, and you can see this based on that bumpy function that we had on the earlier slide, is that they kind of like smooth bumpy functions. So that's kind of one very heuristic thing you can say. I've said all these bad things about neural networks. A nice thing is that you can actually look at the hidden layers and get a sense of what the features are. And that's actually a kind of a common thing to do in neural networks. So if the, for example, if the input is an image, I could look at the activations of each of the hidden layer on each of the images and look at what features the network is producing, right? So it might be, so say if I had one, so say in the first layer, maybe I'd have one neuron. If I had one neuron for each pixel, it might look at many, if I have, say, I don't want to say this. I can arrange, actually, this is going to be easier to say when I look at an example, and so I have, which I have here. I'm going to do the examples in the reverse order. Okay, so here is one example of a neural network that has been, that's been very successful. So this is on the task of recognizing handwritten digits. So every check that you write, and every post that you send is scanned by machine to read the postcode or to read the numbers on the check. And those are all read automatically. And the systems for doing this have very, very high accuracy. Actually, many of the systems, although not all, but many of the fielded systems are actually based on neural networks. So here's an example of one that this system actually has been fielded in practice for reading handwritten digits. So what this thing on the left would be an image of a digit, say, from a check. So this is kind of a grid. You think of this grid as being a matrix, and each element of the matrix is going to be the pixel from a scanned in handwritten digit. So they do some preprocessing steps that actually a relatively small number of preprocessing steps in terms of like finding where the digits are in the check and segmenting the digits in order to get to that representation. So that's the input layer. So then you have the hidden layer here is actually a bit complex. So they have four different hidden layers. And so you see those are the four different things here. So each element in this, each element in this matrix corresponds to one hidden unit. Now this isn't fully connected, like this network is not fully connected, unlike the ones that we've seen before. And the reason, there are a couple of reasons for that. One is that he wants to have a fewer number of weights. And then the other one is that he wants to bias the network. They want to bias the network to have such that these hidden units represent kind of local features of the image, right? So I might want some hidden unit that does something like, oh, do I see a certain, I might want to hope that it learns things like, do I see a stroke in some certain region of the image? So what these things do is this hidden unit, oh, I have one of these things. This hidden unit right here has weights that link it to all of the input units of some region of the input. And then each one of these hidden units is going to link to a different region and have its own set of weights. So what that means is after you've trained this network, you can actually look at this hidden layer, and you can say, give it an image, and then look at the, say, 0, 1 output that you get from this hidden layer, and you get another image. Right? So you can say, so that gives you some idea of, like, well, what features are on for this particular image? And so it doesn't just have one layer that does. So each layer is designed to find, is looking to find a different kind of feature from the image. So he actually has four parallel layers, which don't talk to each other, but all talk to the image in this kind of convolutional kind of way. I don't want to talk about what convolution is, but it's basically this idea of depending on local regions of the image. Okay, so that's what gives you the first hidden layer. This thing actually has, because of the large number of features here, you actually do another trick on top of this, which is you actually try to get a lower dimensional representation of the image. So we'll talk about some methods we'll talk about dimensionality reduction more either next class or the class after that. But you say, well, rather than having this large number of features, I want to condense them into some smaller number of features. So I'll do the same kind of trick, where I have some neuron here that gets to talk to a small number of now these nonlinear features based on the input. And so now I have four layers here that all depend on this input here. And then I can add another hidden layer that does the same kind of convolutional thing as here. And then another sampling unit does the same kind of convolutional thing as here. So by adding an additional set of hidden layers, the idea is to get kind of more flexibility in terms of the nonlinear features that I get out here. And then finally, at the end, I have a set of output units. I have 26 output units, one for each character in the alphabet. And so each of these guys get to look at these processed features to try to decide which letter it's going to be. And this thing was actually trained on, this was trained 15 years ago, so they had much less computational power at the time. This is something that would have taken probably a couple days, maybe days or even a week to train at the time, based on thousands of inputs of handwritten digits. So I won't go into. We have one more example, which I won't go into in detail. But you can look at it either. You can look at it either on the slide or the original paper. This is something, a more recent paper that's been very influential. And here they're actually looking at probability distributions over strings in the language. So each one of these things, A, B, and C, are different words. And so you want to predict, you want to get some probability distribution over all of the words on this slide. And there are reasons why you want that if you're doing, that thing's very useful to have in natural language processing.